Thank you. Can you hear me over there? Okay. All right. Journal for a Fractured Knee. And it starts with a quote from Robert Lowell. Yet, why not say what happened? I'm a pasha on a red divan. I call out to my lover, bring me the phone before you leave. He's taking a bottle of Perrier and pain pills. No narcotics, just Tylenol extra strength up to put by my bed. He's on his way to a lecture and home to his own apartment. And when the door closes, a hush will come to my life. Even though he'll be back tomorrow to take me on errands and fix dinner, the hush of the forgotten, or something like forgotten, the unreachable writer. My house has become Paris in the 20s. This one upholstered chair and ottoman has become the cafe where all the expats meet. For the first time in my 50 years as a public writer, I can say no without guilt, no to readings and travel, no to letters. I'm anemic, faint. Like Emily, I have a vague illness. And this is a quote from James Thurber. You might as well fall flat on your face as to lean over too far backwards. And it was like that, going down flat on my face, with all of gravity pulling every part of my body equally. There was nothing holding back. I was in Whole Foods, balancing three basil plants in my arms, when I tripped over a pallet of watermelons as I turned. Oh, I said to myself, oh, I know what this is, this falling flat on your face. I did this many times when I was 7. The amygdala shot up an image that I fit my whole body into as I fell forward, a kind of aluminum suitcase, and all the worries of aging left me. I would have walked away and thought nothing of it, but a little bird of caution warned, it wouldn't hurt to let the manager know. When he came, I acted as if I was Superwoman. Of course I didn't need an ambulance. I would drive myself home. In fact, when I came back a few days later, they had moved the watermelons. Whole Foods will send me $250 worth of gift cards. I didn't sue. It would take too much of the energy I want to use for these words. Is it possible to edge into the stream of a new life or even into the cold ocean of it? You don't have to believe in it. You don't even have to know what it is or understand or rely on your powers. Mainly, it is a way of letting go of the larger elements, adjusting to the temperature of the doing, but slowly. Take as long as you like. There is time. How my body has changed in the past year. I've lost the clear line of the jaw, which now has a heaviness and lack of definition, like an elephant's jaw. The lines and creases faint now, but set, imaginable. Though I am at a lower weight than in years, my jeans don't fasten. It's not only the belly fat, the whole pelvis seems to have dropped. Why else would the V between my legs be nearly mid-thigh? I know the insides grow thick and heavy. Sophia Loren had her vagina lifted, sewn tight as a facelift. But no one tells you that the modest, tight-fitting pants of the young are partly the result of the vulva being fastened to tightly anchored bones. You're laughing at the right places. I scoot in backwards to the back seat of my sweetheart's car. I pull my butt over the hump, dragging the dead weight of my braced leg, a 30-pound leg of lamb. I'm meat in a long violin case. I don't belong to me. My daughter-in-law, who is a therapist, has learned a great deal by working with the victims of trauma, and she wonders if my fall had anything to do with the way people, after trauma, lose their ability to act by instinct in their own defense. It's true, I liked giving myself over to a force of nature. In childhood, I was a very successful faller. I was famously clumsy, as my father said. It's more than my knee. I'm changing. It's the reason I'm experiencing so much frustration. All the balls I used to keep balancing with so much effort now, even with all the effort, takes enormous strain. My fall is evidence. I need to divest myself. I must do the things I need to do to take care of financial matters. I must write. I must plan for my future, which means to find a home where my needs will be met as I, what word should I use? Fail? I think the important thing is not to spend the next 5 years full of fear, shame, and regret. I must plan what I need to do, and as Bill Stafford said, who was my great teacher, revise your life. I am thinking with sorrow of those who couldn't change, the poets who committed suicide, Plath, of course, Berryman, of Hemingway with the gun in his mouth, of Ralph Ellison, who would not support young black writers. They weren't good enough, he said, not as good as he was, but who never finished his second book, of Anatole Broillard, who couldn't write the autobiography that he had been paid for because he couldn't go beyond the first sentence, that all those years he was drama critic for the New York Times, he had been passing for white. And there are those who face the truth the first time, but then when the truth changes, they can't do it again, as if the old truth has made a self so vain that it can't let go. And I think of the great writers who do change. Jerry Stern, 86, writing 2 books a year, much prose, not like the old books of poetry, but I love them even more because they show so clearly the bare fluctuations of a brilliant mind. During the night, I think Bill came to me. It seems as if he handed me a coat. I remember a coat rack on the wall, like one of those in my third grade closet. A school closet. In a way, I am a child. I have to start again. I am in the school of the fractured knee. We went to see Charlie Chaplin in 3 silent films tonight, all that balancing and falling, diving and leaping on skates, sinking backwards almost to the floor, and then staying like that, almost flat on his back, his skates a blur of movement, seemed impossible. The professor said he believed Charlie Chaplin was the greatest ballet dancer of all times. The actors used the clicking of the reel of film as a metronome so that they wouldn't run into each other. Then he had us stand, close our eyes, and try to stand still, noticing how we had to keep adjusting on the balls of our feet, catching ourselves. We are all in a constant state of falling. And now I'll read the other 250 pages. I'm not kidding. Oh, God, it's good to have something to write about. I'll take anything, right? Fractured knee is good. I'll go for that. Okay. So I was thinking today about Detroit. And someone came out. I'll talk to you about Detroit later. But I was worried about... And when I was growing up in the 40s, 50s, even before that, the 30s, there were these middle-class neighborhoods where it was possible to make this transition, and it was kind of a good life, these middle-class neighborhoods. And, you know, for black people, at one time, we lived all together in a place in many large cities called Black Bottom. And Toni Morrison talks about the joke in Sula, where the black guy asks the white guy after the Civil War, why do we always get all the property at the top of the land? The fertile land is the land at the bottom. And the white person answers, your land is the bottom of heaven. So I'm going to read 2 poems about this place that we sort of came to, this black middle-class neighborhood, Conant Gardens, and how we related to Black Bottom, which was, there was a longing and a hunger there and a sense of breaking, but also a sense of moving up and the issues that that caused. So I'll read an older poem and a new poem, Black Bottom. When relatives came from out of town, we would drive down to Black Bottom, drive slowly down the main streets, Bobian and Hastings, trapped in the mesh of Saturday night. Freshly escaped, black middle class, we snickered and were proud. The louder the streets, the prouder. We laughed at the bright clothes of a prostitute, a man sitting on a curb with his bottle in his hand. We smelled barbecue, cooking in dented wash tubs, and our mouths watered. As much as we wanted it, we couldn't take the chance. Rhythm and blues came from the window, the throaty voice of a woman lost in the bass and the drums, in the dirty down and out, the grind. I love to see a funeral, then I know it ain't mine. We rolled our windows down so that the waves rolled over us like blood. We hoped to pass invisibly, knowing on Monday we would return safely to our jobs, the post office and classroom. We wanted our sufferings to be offered up as tender meat, and our triumphs to be belted out in raucous song. We had lost our voice in the suburbs, in Conant Gardens, where each brick house delineated a fence of silence. We had lost the right to sing in the street and damn creation. We returned to wash our hands of them, to smell them, whose very existence tore us down to the human. Style. Weekend guests from Chicago, 1945. In their brand new caramel Cadillac, Julia and Walter arrived at 4, trunks stuffed with leather suitcases, steaks and oysters in a chilled cooler, champagne and Walter's only, Johnny Walker Blue. Julia, hands flaring in the clunky music of a pound of real gold charms. Walter, teddy bear big, in a tan linen jacket and shoes soft as old money. Kind to a fault and sweet, he teased the women to laughter and let his wife reign queen in a diamond ring to knock your eyes out. She was known from New York to L.A. for her fried chicken and greens and didn't hesitate after hours of driving to throw an apron over a French cotton dress and slap the flour on 30 or more pieces. Oh, the chicken breasts and thighs spattering juicy in just the right degree of heat as she told stories hilarious and true to a kitchen full of steamy women that made us double over and pee on ourselves. Saturday morning, men to golf and women in floral robes with cups of a New Orleans blend so strong they said it stained the rim and turned you black. Me in a high chair, straining for language, my bottle stirred with a spoon of coffee and half a pint of cream. At 15, on my first trip cross-country on a train, I stopped in Chicago to spend the night. We grabbed the L to Marshall Fields, where Julia bought the first expensive cold creams for my face and hosed the colors of which, for the first time, matched the colors of our skins. She told me she had lovers, one a handsome Pullman porter. On the last two nights of my journey, I myself received a similar service. A café au lait gentleman woke me mornings by sticking his hand through the sealed drapes and gently shaking my rump. I waited all night, damp with wonder. She had a wart on her chin or nose, I can't remember which, but she wore it like exquisite jewelry, like Marilyn Monroe wore her beauty mark with unforgettable style. Elegy for my husband, Bruce Derricott, June 22, 1928, June 21, 2011. What was there is no longer there. Not the blood running its wires of flame through the whole length. Not the memories, the texts written in the language of the flat hills. No, not the memories. The porch swing and the father crying. The genteel and elegant aunt bleeding out on the highway, too black for the white ambulance to pick up. Who had sent back lacquered plates from China, who had given away her best ivory comb that one time she was angry. Not the muscles, the ones the white girls longed to touch, but must not. For your mother warned you would be lynched in that all-white town you grew up in. Not that same town where you were the only, the one good black boy, all that is gone. Not the muscles running, the baseball flying into your mitt. Not the hand that laid itself over my heart and saved me. Not the eyes that held the long gold tunnel I believed in. Not the restrained hand in love and in anger. Not the holding back. Not the taut holding. Billy in Frankfurt, 1954. These were the last few years of her life. The German audiences, who often recognized black artists in a way white Americans did not, welcomed her with an uproar, hoots and hollers of joy and expectation. I'm gonna love you like nobody's loved you. Come rain or come shine. At first, tentative, drug slow and heartless, as if she wasn't, as Carmen McRae once said, only happy when she sang, or as if, maybe now, she was never happy, nearly dead and propped up on the bones of her reputation. Then, as if their desire finally broke ice, she rose to the top of the band, taking her tag turn in and out. High as a mountain, deep as a river, come rain or come shine. The phrasing Billy said, Pops taught her, Pops is, anybody know who Pops is? Yeah. The phrasing Billy said, Pops taught her. The phrasing Frank said, Billy taught him. Those are such great songs. That last album. God, oh my God. Untitled. 10 days after her death, I nap on my mother's bed. And for the first time, it seems in years, in front of the gentle eyes of the Blessed Virgin, my mother's Palm Sunday palms folded behind the frame, I feel my clitoris throb. Aroused? In my mother's bed? Good laugh. Nice. It's not funny when it happens, but later it was like, what? In my mother's bed? Before the Virgin? I press my thighs together as if my hands must remain clean. I touch the tip of my left breast until the nipple grows hard and lifts. My thighs tighten. Embraced in this pleasure, as in a prayer that goes up from my whole body, I have gone beyond some dirtiness, some act I cannot conceive my mother would have condoned. Yet, here, now, I have touched some deeper. All right. Yet, right in the middle of this is bad. I gotta start again. No, I don't. Yet, here, now, I have touched some deeper female presence that her death gives me as a gift. And then one last poem. Grad class with famous poets. The teachers, except for Phil Levine, who was extremely outspoken. Once I heard him tell a poet that his poem was crap. Said very little. Yehuda Amakai said nothing. And Galway's classes often descended into silence, perhaps like at a Quaker meeting when no one has anything of importance to say. Still, as little as he said, his body couldn't help but respond. I would watch his hands and eyebrows to decipher the irrevocable twitch. He had a very exact idea about the nature of a poet's work and didn't speak, I think, partly out of kindness. One evening, Louis Simpson handed out a poem from a popular little magazine about Carl Sandburg. The famous poet, then in his dotage, and sometimes trotted out at cocktail parties for rich patrons, but who had to be carefully watched, once got away from his keepers. Meanwhile, the young poet who had written the poem was backing out of the driveway and almost ran over him. The poem then wondered what would have happened if he actually had run over Carl Sandburg. Would he have been famous for it, renowned, published widely? Or would he be reviled, whispered about? There is the poet who killed Carl Sandburg. Louis put the poem down on the desk and looked at us gravely. But I am actually the poet who almost ran over Carl Sandburg. The young poet had heard Louis tell this story and written the poem that Louis never wrote. The class was silent. Write your own poems, he warned, and waited. And then we began.